Welcome to Beyond90Seconds.com, the podcast, everybody. I'm Mark Horner. Thank you so much for joining us. Today, we have a very special guest. It is the British journalist, Alex Hannaford, who has written both articles for a newspaper, for magazines, and he has written books as well on a variety of topics, to include the Wayne Bent case out of New Mexico. In fact, on June 14th, 2009, the Sunday Times in the UK published the article written by Mr. Hannaford, Wayne Bent, The Cult of the Man They Called Messiah. It is an insightful, it is a fascinating article, as Mr. Hannaford went from place to place, person to person, key player to key player within this story, which has attracted not just national attention, but international attention. The influence of this man, Wayne Bent, on not just adults, but children, and the controversies that swirled around this case. More on that article in just a moment. First, though, I want to go to Alex Hannaford's website, where I'm going to read word for word his bio. Reading from alexhannaford.com, his biography. Alex Hannaford has worked as a journalist and editor for 12 years and is a regular contributor to some of the UK's biggest newspapers and magazines and to publications in the US, Hong Kong, and Australia. He was a feature writer, section editor, and commissioning editor on the London Evening Standard before going freelance in 2003. In 2006, he wrote a biography of rock star Pete Doherty for Random House and ghosted My Prodigal Son, published by Headline the same year. Based in Texas, he has written about two presidential elections, the emotive issues surrounding the death penalty, and human interest stories for newspapers such as The Guardian, Observer, Independent, and Sunday Times Magazine. He was editor of Austin Monthly, the city magazine in Austin, Texas, has worked as a senior lecturer in journalism at Kingston University, and contributed to The Rough Guide to West Africa. In 2007, Alex was shortlisted for Best Journalism at the Diageo Africa Reporting Awards for his coverage of the Nigerian culture and politics. Alex has written for The Guardian, Observer, Telegraph, Evening Standard, Independent, and Sunday Times Magazine, among others. He currently lives in Austin, Texas. Alex Hannaford, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thanks, Mark.
Let's talk about Wayne Bent. And I mentioned that you had an article earlier, actually in June, just a couple of months ago. But your story with Mr. Bent goes back years. In fact, you first wrote about him in 2004. Tell me why.
That's right, yeah. Actually, I was based in Texas in 2000, moved here in 2003 initially, and I was writing a lot of sort of human interest stories, and you know, you're always looking for sort of the next kind of story that you think might be interesting, and I just stumbled upon a piece online. It was from a TV station actually that just put on their website. It was a very, very small news piece about this group that moved to near Clayton, New Mexico. And I think, I can't remember exactly what had happened, but the news piece wasn't particularly revealing. I just kind of, I don't know what really caught my eye, but there was something interesting about it, about this and the idea of a sort of small town kind of dealing with a religious cult kind of moving in there, and how normal townsfolk kind of feel about people that are seen as different. So I kind of got in touch with them via email. They had a website at the time. I can't remember which one it was. They've had several over the years. And I got in touch with them, and it took me about 6 months of emailing back and forth with Wayne, actually, directly, for him to sort of agree for me to go up there and meet him. And it was something that they'd never sort of done a proper kind of full-on interview before. I think they'd just done kind of brief snippets with the local sort of TV news media or whatever, but just on the phone. So they'd never done a sort of proper interview. So I sort of said to him, you know, I'd really like to pitch this. I'd like to do a story on you guys, a big feature on what's going on. And I knew that he was claiming to be Messiah, which kind of for me was the sort of fascinating thing. You know, in England, we'd read about the Waco Branch Davidians, and you know, always kind of this perception that there are a lot of sort of religious cults in sort of Middle America, and there's actually quite a few in the UK as well, but I guess they don't make headlines as much as the ones over here do. So it's kind of fascinating to me, and we sort of kept this email banter going back and forward, just sort of leading up to me going out there and trying to find when the time was right. He wanted to know that I'd done my research, basically. So they sent me some CD-ROMs of sort of all the stuff that they'd had on their website over the years. So I kind of waded into this and learned a lot about them. And then eventually, as I say, about 6 months later, I got the go-ahead to go up and meet them. So a friend of mine who drove and myself went, you know, made the journey actually by car from Austin, Texas to Clayton. And they live, once you're in Clayton, which is a small enough town in itself, they actually live about 40 miles down a dirt road from Clayton. So it's very, very, very remote, very difficult. It's not difficult to get to, but it is very, very remote. And they're very isolated, very cut off. And then, and we did, you know, I spent a couple of days up there and I think a day actually with them, a sort of full day with them, meeting the different people there and Jeff, Wayne's son, and had an interview with Wayne himself and sort of tried to get an idea of what they all believed and why, how they came to believe that this guy was the son of God, which is what they believe.
And where did this initial article appear?
That piece was in a magazine called Bizarre in the UK, which is a sort of they kind of specialize in sort of kind of offbeat stuff, I guess. And it wasn't going to be for Bizarre originally. It was, I mean, I kind of wanted to do it, and I wasn't sure whether it would fall into sort of broadsheet territory or you know, magazine or whatever. I wasn't really sure where it would be placed, because something like this, nothing really major had happened, so it wasn't like the FLDS, which became international news, you know, with Warren Jeffs. So there was nothing really kind of different enough. There was no siege like in Waco, you know. There was no kind of I think that some people had suggested these guys had weapons, but they certainly told me they didn't, and I've never ever thought that they did have. I kind of always seen them as a very sort of peaceful people, so there was no real kind of major newsworthy hook, I guess you could say. So it was for Bizarre magazine, and then but after that was published, I was kind of always conscious that this story would run and run, and that there would eventually be something. I always wanted to go back and do something more extensive and sort of for another publication. I always had a broadsheet in mind, and the Sunday Times magazine, you know, was an ideal vehicle for it, really, I think, because it was a, you know, a sensible story, and it was sort of 4,000 words long, and I think you know, it was something that I could kind of really get my teeth into it, and kind of having followed them since 2004 or 2003, and sort of following them all the way along. And then there was, in between that time, there was the National Geographic documentary over here, so they'd kind of suddenly become news, if you like. And then Wayne was put into prison, as you know, so then suddenly there was a sort of a hook for doing a bigger piece.
In your initial piece, and for the uninitiated, for those people who have not heard of the story before or heard very little about it, no doubt you described the remoteness, you described the living off the land, essentially, plain clothes, no makeup, long dresses, kind of what we typically see in some of the high-profile cult cases here in the U.S., right?
Mm. It's kind of interesting. When you know, the first time I ever went up there, the first thing you think when you see these guys and you kind of see the way they live, and this is in 2003, not in 2009, for a reason I'll explain in a minute, but in 2003 certainly you've got a group of people living on hundreds of acres of land in mobile homes, but they've also got sort of structures as well. They've built a wooden church, and they've got sort of the existing buildings that were there on the land when they bought the land back in whenever it was, I think it was 2000. And they're all growing their own vegetables, and it's sort of, you know, it's very much a sort of communal subsistence lifestyle. And it was actually really, really, you know, a nice lifestyle. You know, you're actually sort of envious of them. And they were sort of explaining to me that there's no crime. Their kids are homeschooled. They grow their own vegetables. Everything is kind of pulled into a pot. And you think, well, this is wonderful. And then you have Wayne Bent in the middle of it, and there's this guy who is claiming he's the Messiah, and they all hang off his every word. And believe, you know, wholeheartedly that he is. And that, to, they would say to the outsider, that's just because you don't have the faith and you don't understand. But I mean, you know, to anyone else, you'd think, well, that's the problem with this thing. You know, that they're totally enthralled to this one man, and he, you know, even though, yeah, I've said this in the latest piece, they're free to walk off the property anytime they want, they're not free mentally, because they're totally enthralled to this one guy who they think is the son of God.
Ben Anthony was the man behind the documentary that first made a splash. That was initially in the UK in December of, I believe it might have been 2007.
Mm-hmm.
The End of the World Cult was the name of the program, which was later reworked to become the National Geographic program. I'm just curious, do you think perhaps Ben Anthony, who I've interviewed in the past but have not asked the question, perhaps he'd seen your piece and maybe the documentary was sprung from him having read what you had written?
He actually did. Yeah, that is how it happened. I got an email back in when my piece appeared in 2004, and I had an email from a producer by the name of Eddie Stafford saying he'd read the piece and he was interested in doing a documentary. And initially, I was going to be involved in that, and for various reasons that didn't happen. But I've spoken to Ben. Ben and I have communicated by email, but I've never met him. But Eddie and I met a few times actually to discuss this in London. And then Eddie ended up going over to the States and spending a few days with Wayne and Jeff and the followers of Wayne Bent up at Strong City. The documentary was made, and it was big in the UK. You know, it was an hour long documentary in the UK, and then it had obviously the National Geographic, and then the follow up National Geographic documentary as well, which was on the court case. So that kind of brought it into the kind of public domain, and then the Sunday Times piece kind of brought everything up to date, because the documentary only went up to the court case was never broadcast in the UK, so the documentary in the UK only went up to the allegations of child abuse, and shortly after that aired, I believe that's when the Child Protective Services came in and the police got involved. So the Sunday Times piece was sort of bringing the story up to date and kind of reflecting on the last 4 or 5 years.
I would like to know your reaction to that moment in the documentary, The End of the World Cult, later the National Geographic program Inside a Cult. And I presume you've watched both versions.
Yeah.
What was your reaction when you see that highly controversial moment where two young ladies are at the sink at Strong City, Wayne Bent's land, and they're washing dishes and talking about having lain naked with Wayne Bent? That certainly got a lot of attention, a lot of play, and was perhaps one of the, if not the most controversial bit in the whole documentary. As you watched that, what was your reaction?
I wasn't surprised at all. I mean, they would have it that it was a spiritual healing, and the court decided that no, it wasn't. It was child abuse, basically. So it didn't surprise me that they were saying that. No, not at all. When I did the first story for Bizarre, I interviewed a girl called Adora, and they all have different names. They changed their names as well because she's now called Danielle. And when I interviewed her, she was 17, and she told me that she told me this story that one night in the early hours of the morning, she was kind of in her bed, and she was thinking, she was asking God this and that, and Wayne Bent he knocked on her door and went into the room in the early hours of the morning. And she said that when he looked at me, I knew that he was who he said he was. Now, she didn't say that he lay naked with her, but the idea of a man of that age going into a 17-year-old girl's room at the crack of dawn was kind of, I mean, I think when that happened, I wasn't surprised that this had happened. I mean, it's kind of, you've seen it all before. They will have it, and it's kind of difficult for me because going up there, you do, and I know Ben Anthony had this as well with these people. You know Jeff and all the other guys. You they're really, really lovely people, and you warm to them. They're so kind and so nice, and they genuinely believe with all their heart that they are with somebody who is the Son of God, and to me, it's and they will dispute this till the day they die. But to me, it's classic brainwashing, and they say no, their brain has been washed, but it's been washed clean of all the bad thoughts. You've seen that on the documentary. So it's difficult to kind of criticize, but I will criticize him. I mean, I don't criticize them because I think that they're misguided in their faith. I think it's a tragedy actually, and I've told Jeff that. So this is not something that I'm sort of just telling you and I'm saying one thing to you and one thing to them. I do think it's tragic that you have a group of people that are so enthralled to one man that they will literally do anything, you know. And we've seen that with Esther's fast as well. She would have fasted till death. And I actually asked her that. Would you have fasted till death if God had told me to do that? Yes. And her mother knows that as well, because I spoke to her about it. And when you've got people that think they are so right in what they believe that they would die for their beliefs, then, you know, you've got a tragedy waiting to happen. I mean, it could happen. I think I got off topic a bit then. What was the question?
No, that's just fine. I had asked you whether or not you were surprised at all by the scene at the kitchen sink. Another scene that people talked about quite a bit was the moment where there's this discussion with Wayne Bent and his son Jeff, who you've alluded to, and Wendy, who had been Jeff's wife, but now we're learning in this scene, has basically left his bed for her father-in-law's bed, Wayne Bent's bed. Mm. Was that at all surprising to you?
Yeah, actually that was, because when I went there before, Wendy, who's now known as Christiana, was there. I remember them, Jeff and Wendy sitting in the rocker outside their mobile home chatting to me, and we did some photos and stuff. And yeah, I mean, you know, they lived together as husband and wife, and, you know, to then in a physically see that his father was now sort of sleeping with his wife. I mean, he says it's his ex-wife because they kind of split up beforehand. But even so, in the film, you know, Jeff puts his head against the side of the thing, and he says that was to do with the editing and that he wasn't. But, you know, I mean, he comes across and says, no, this was the right thing. I saw God in it. But, I mean, it was difficult. I think Jeff would concede that it was probably the most difficult thing that he's ever been through. And, you know, to anyone on the outside, they would say, well, yeah, this is just another example of how your dad has got an unbelievable grip of power over his followers, including, and he would do this to his own son. So to the outside world, you know, you'd think this is crazy. This is completely crazy. You know, I mean, this guy is not only, when I went up there the first time, had taken three of the women away from their, two of the women away from their husbands and consummated the relationships, and their husbands were still on the land up there, and, you know, I interviewed one of them at the time. But I mean, you just can't even imagine how this can happen. How can a group get to the stage where one guy can basically take away, you know, dissolve all these marriages and then start sleeping with the women up there, and for the guys to sit back and watch this happening? It's just, it's unfathomable, really.
Well, let's delve into your article, which I think does a very good job of getting through the story in a swift way, although when I print it out with the font at 12 type size, I get 6 pages, but it doesn't feel like 6 pages.
Right.
At the beginning, you begin describing what it's like up in Clayton, New Mexico, and you focus on a mobile home, which most people probably wouldn't even give any notice to. And the context is, there it is. You wouldn't notice it, but boy, that's basically the center of the storm of this court case because, again, for the uninitiated, when this thing finally goes to trial, it comes down to two alleged victims at the time, two sisters, both teenagers at the time, who the state contends have been touched sexually, inappropriately, obviously, by Wayne Bent. And there were the charges also involved contributing to the delinquency of minors.
Right.
So you take us inside that mobile home, and lo and behold, it is the home of John and Elsa Sayre, the parents of those two girls. And that's where your storytelling begins to unfold. Take me inside that moment and what it's like to begin telling the story from their perspective, two parents who actually stood up to Wayne Bent when everybody else seemed to be following, quote unquote, the Messiah.
It's kind of interesting, actually, because to backtrack, you know, a bit, when a minute ago when you were asking me, and like I was explaining, that it's difficult to kind of be very, very, I will be critical of him, because I feel that he, well, Wayne Bent believes in his own messianic status, and he believes his own stuff, but it's very difficult to be critical of the group because they are such lovely people, and the reason I bring that up is because when you speak to Elsa and John, her husband, for the first time, you realize quite quickly that they'll be very, very, they'll stand by what they did, and they think they did the right thing, and they're glad they did it. They also are reluctant to be too critical. And it's kind of interesting because John, in fact, there was one thing, I think, I don't know if you read that when the trial happened and John and Elsa were willing to take the stand, when they saw Wayne Bent for the first time, John went up and hugged him. And that was misinterpreted by a lot of people there that maybe he, you know, but he tried to explain this to me. And he said, you know, when you've lived with a group that long and you look back over the kind of the early days when originally it was exactly the picture I painted of this communal living and everyone was, you know, cordial to each other and they were the best of friends. I mean, these were your family. And it's very difficult, even when something like this happens, and even what he was saying, even when it involves your daughters, to hate somebody. You know, he's glad that he went to trial and that he took the stand, but I think he finds it very difficult to hate Wayne Bent.
You know, and so I'll interject very quickly. You so remind me of my experience in interviewing Johnny Miller, who is a former member who I interviewed for a mini web documentary that I did. And while he will say critical things of Wayne Bent, he will also say many things in his defense, almost as if he feels this passion for the man, despite the fact that this man, that Johnny Miller's wife moved on to Wayne Bent. So I totally relate to, through that window, Johnny Miller, what you're describing to me with the Sayers and others.
Yeah, it's interesting. And actually, I found that Elsa Sayer was less willing to give him the benefit, not the benefit of the doubt, but you know what I'm saying. Elsa was far more willing to, I don't know if attack's the right word, but to really say it like it was. I mean, she felt that her two daughters were totally manipulated by an older man who brainwashed, I don't know if she used the phrase brainwashing, but who, you know, effectively brainwashed his group into believing he was the son of God. And Elsa is now just distraught that her other daughter, Lakeisha, you know, wants to go back to Strong City. But I think she's kind of, I think Elsa is sort of also very much aware that, you know, Wayne's in prison. And while he can still evangelize to his faithful via, you know, I don't know if you saw in the piece that he phones Jeff on a daily basis. Jeff records the interviews. He uploads them to a password-protected website that only the group have access to. And this message is then downloaded as an audio file to everybody in the group. They've all got laptops, and wherever they are, I mean, Lakeisha's now currently working for on a ranch not far from Strong City, looking after an elderly lady who's disabled, and she still has her laptop and is able to download these sermons. So, you know, Wayne Bent's still getting his message across, but despite this, I think Lakeisha is kind of, you know, happy that Wayne's in prison and that Lakeisha's sort of starting to make a career for herself in the sort of caring industry, if you like, albeit one that's quite close to Strong City. But I think Lakeisha sort of says that, you know, without Wayne Bent, Strong City isn't really Strong City. There's no danger, there's no threat at Strong City without Wayne Bent.
A couple of things of interest. Number one, that website never used to be password protected. Have you asked Jeff or have you asked Wayne why it has become password protected? Because a lot of people like to go there and see what's going on.
I think it's a different website, actually, because when I went up in June, the website that they had running, I think it was just strongcity.info, was still up and running, but they still had an intranet, so an internal internet that they all had a password to. So it's all, I think they've always had a sort of private web presence that no one's had access to, except for the members up there. And in terms of their public presence, this is something just to get his message out, but it's you know, it's edited and it's kind of it that they put out what they want to put out. And in the past, it was called, I don't know if you ever saw, there was a website called The Editorial. It was the-editorial.com, and that was one of theirs as well. And it was supposed to be a sort of news magazine, but with Wayne's message. And over the years, it's been several different things. Traverser.com, I think, was one of them. There's been different ones all along the line. They own several different website addresses, and they just take them offline as and when. And over the years that I've followed them, there's been times when everything's been shut down and they have a period of sort of, you know, if you like, just sort of contemplation and kind of going back into the wilderness and kind of shutting themselves off. And of course, at that point, everyone on the outside thinks, oh, they must be committing suicide, which was obviously never had never happened. And I admit that when I first wrote my first article, that was the perception that you know, are these guys a suicide cult, like the documentary had said, you know, the end of the world cult. And they laugh about that and say, well, actually, they don't laugh. They're actually really, really upset about that. That was the one thing they were really upset about, is because they've said that they're not a suicide cult. They're not about to take their own lives. But of course, you know, like I said before, there's drinking your Jim Jones drink, and there's starving yourself to death. Both are suicide. So if you're willing to fast until death, then you're still taking your own life. And I don't think there's anybody up at Strong City who isn't willing to starve until death if God, in inverted commas, tells them to.
In your piece, this is the story you wrote in June for the Times, it was apparent that you began to wonder, why is it that Wayne Bent is allowed to get these calls out, these recordings made, and in a sense maintain his influence over members of the sect? And I'll read from one of the paragraphs here, and we'll get to your visit with Wayne Bent in prison in just a moment. But you write, quote, "On the way out of the prison, I ask one of the officials why Bent is allowed to make as many phone calls as he does, all of which are relayed to his followers. Quote, the free speech laws in this country are very powerful, he tells me, and you're referring to a corrections officer working at the facility in Los Lunas, New Mexico, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Would that fly in England?
Well, actually, it's interesting because there was something else in that quote that was edited out due to space, and that was that he said that a few years ago an inmate was presenting a sports radio show from his cell.
That would have been interesting to read as well. Yeah. do you believe it's a fair assertion that Wayne Bent continues to maintain influence over members of Strong City through these recordings?
You know, I think that I was speaking to a guy called Rick Ross. If you've come across Rick Ross before, he's cult expert. He's not a psychologist, but he's been an exit counselor for various. He actually counseled two of the Branch Davidians when they after the siege in '93, and he maintains a huge archive of information about cults and new groups, new religious groups. And he was saying to me that you know, the problem is that Wayne Bent can exert his control over the group if he's allowed to do these daily updates, if you like, daily sermons. I'm not so sure. I think at the moment, yes, he can. Can it last for 8 years, 10 years? That's what I'm not so sure about.
Yes,
I think they need. I think they need him there.
Yeah, I see. Within your piece, towards the back end of it, you had written, quoting Ross, that he basically felt that if these lines of communication were cut off, that the group might disintegrate. So that's a pretty strong statement. You're not so convinced.
No, I think I am convinced that they could disintegrate in terms of disperse. I think that there will be no. I mean, this is one of the things I alluded to earlier when I said that in 2003 I'd gone up and there was this sense that this community was wonderful and they had all this kind of, you know, growing their own vegetables and homeschooling their own kids. I went back up there this year, and you know, it's very, very, very clear that things have changed. You know, not only is Wayne Bent not there, but there's no kids up there. None of the vegetables and fruit and stuff are growing. They're not even bothering to grow that anymore. It feels like things are finished there. And it's, Jeff said exactly the same thing to me. Our work here is done, was the way he put it. But their life in Clayton, New Mexico, is over. Now, what's going to happen? I don't know. There are a couple of them have actually moved into a house to be nearer to Wayne Bent, nearer the prison, so they can go and visit him. One of the girls that I interviewed back in 2003 is now working in a spa in elsewhere in New Mexico, in northern New Mexico. You know, they're all starting, and obviously Lakeisha's working, you know, looking after this old lady on the ranch. They're starting to kind of integrate more into society and sort of dissipate. And, you know, my prediction is that unless Wayne Bent starves himself, so unless Wayne Bent fasts in prison, then I think that eventually they will all start to move out and get jobs in the community. And you know, some of them will succeed and some of them won't be able to cope with life on the outside. I know Jeff has worked in sort of, he's kind of very into the whole website build and technology and kind of that kind of thing. So, you know, my prediction is Jeff will probably leave and get a job somewhere as a webmaster. I think that's what he'd quite like to do. And you know, I mean, we've sort of talked kind of off the record kind of thing about this. Not say off the record, it was just a sort of casual conversation, but you know, what would happen. And but the thing is, none of them can say, none of them will say what's going to happen, because they can't tell, because they feel that, you know, God is leading them and God will tell them what to do. But yeah, they're the two options. Basically, number one, they will all kind of dissipate and go and get jobs wherever. Some of them will cope, some of them won't. I don't know what will happen to the ones that can't cope, but I do know that people that have left that group before have, there's been a couple of them that have come close to suicide because they can't cope with what's happened to them in the past and reconciling it with sort of going back into the world as we know it. If Wayne Bent starves himself, which is, you know, he's fasted before, but came off his fast. If he fasts until death, then who knows what's going to happen? I believe that some of them will fast with him. And Wayne has actually said that to me. You know, some of them won't be able to, if he doesn't live, he doesn't think he'll survive. If he loses his appeal, he doesn't think he'll survive in prison. Now, you don't just die in prison. Because they feed you in prison and they give you water in prison. So, you know, if he doesn't feel he's going to survive in prison, then he's got to die somehow. And my view is he will fast until he dies. And if he does that, some of his followers will do that as well.
What's the status of the appeal? These things generally take years.
Yeah, actually, do you know what? I have to say, embarrassingly, I don't know what the latest is. His attorney, I went and visited in New Mexico and had a sit down with him and an interview with him, and the last I heard he was lodging the appeal. I don't know if they've got a date yet, but
and I having covered a high profile murder case in New Mexico, I don't know if the appellate process is the same, but there are generally two stages or phases of the appeal process, and again,
right,
these things can stretch out for years, so I doubt there's a development on the near horizon, but something to follow up on. You know, you spoke a moment ago, Alex, about that transitioning from life within the strong city way of life to the outside world. And you addressed this in part in your article when you wrote about the parents of the victims in this case, John and Elsa. And I'd like to read a quotation from your article. You wrote, "John and Elsa invite me to their trailer. John switches on a disco light. Elsa chooses rock music from the library on her computer and pours us drinks while the blue and red strobes dance around the room. They're a fun couple, like teenagers, who have just discovered a world of alcohol and partying. They're reliving the youth they never had." I found that to be very poignant.
Mm. Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, but I think the difference is that John and Elsa made the decision to leave and to decide that Wayne Bent was a false prophet, a false messiah. So they made the very, very, very difficult decision to not only leave the group, but to say, you know what, we were misled all these years. This guy was a complete phony. He's brainwashed everyone into thinking that he's the son of God. We let our, you know, daughters. So there's the amazing sense of guilt as well that their daughters kind of grew up in this. But I think with John and Elsa, who are, I will say, a fantastic couple, they now want to kind of, you know, do all the things they sort of felt they missed out on. That's not going to happen with everybody, because I think with a lot of people in that group, they're going to leave and go back in, you know, into civilization, into the civilized world or whatever you want to call it, into the outside world, and get jobs or whatever. But I don't think that means that they're going to suddenly start drinking and partying. But I think, you know, some of them will to their dying day believe that Wayne Bent is the son of God. This is just the way it's panned out for them. And the reason I say that is because, in fact, I've just got back from Waco for the second time. I've did a piece for The Guardian on the Branch Davidians 10 years on in 2003, 10 years since the siege. And I've just come back from another trip up there a few weeks ago for another magazine in Australia to do a sort of follow-up on what's happening now. And the surviving Branch Davidians are living, you know, there's some in England, there's some actually been sent back to Australia, but there's some still living in Waco. A couple, Clive Doyle and Catherine Matteson, live upstairs, downstairs from each other in an apartment. She lives in the downstairs apartment. He lives above. They both believe that David Koresh was the Son of God still. They still believe David Koresh is coming back from the dead, so it will be the second coming of Christ, if you like. They believe there's going to be an earthquake in Waco, at Lake Waco, and they are going to survive. David Koresh is going to come back from the dead. All the previous Branch Davidians that died in the blaze are going to come back from the dead and be resurrected. And, you know, Catherine Mattison's 92 now. She's going to die believing that. So, but she's living in the outside world. You know, she, when I was there, she was having a bath fixed by a plumber. She goes to the supermarket and picks up her groceries. So they can function in the outside world with those beliefs. And I think that's what will happen to some of the people up at Strong City.
Near the end of his story for the Sunday Times, Hannaford writes about his one-on-one interview with inmate Wayne Bent. And that is where we begin to wrap up our interview. Speaking of Wayne Bent in prison, you do visit him there, and you tell about it in this article. You say, quote, "I tell Bent his son doesn't think he'll last in prison. Tears well up in his eyes. Quote, I don't have the heart for it, he says after some moments. I think that I would just die of a broken heart." When you're sitting there, I presume, you feel these are genuinely felt emotions. What are you feeling as he wells up?
I think I'm a sucker for the emotional. You know, I sat there and I did feel that they were genuinely held emotions actually. My photographer pointed out afterwards that, you know, he's probably just feeling sorry for himself. I don't know. You know, I mean, she's you know, we had a good chat about this in the car afterwards, and she thinks, I think they were genuine tears, but I, you know, on reflection, yeah, but he probably is thinking, oh dear, you know, this is it. I'm however old he is, 70 odd, and I'm in prison for 10 years. When I go back to the group, is it still going to be there? If it is, you know, there's no children going to be allowed there. He's, you know, registered sex offender for life, probably. I don't know how it works in New Mexico, if it's different, but certainly in other places that's what happens if you've been prosecuted and successfully for a sex offense. So I don't know, he probably thinks it's all fallen apart. So yeah, he's probably feeling very sorry for himself. But like I said to you before, when he says, I'm going to die of a broken heart, people don't die of broken hearts, people die of things. And in prison, you know, unless he gets a disease that's going to kill him, what is going to kill him? And I personally think that if he's got the heart for dying in prison, then he'll take his own life by fasting, because he's done it before, but then stopped. Mm.
Interestingly, you wrap up your article with a final paragraph, which amounts to a commentary, and it's interesting to read what you as the writer have to say in terms of summing it up. You write, "Even Lakeisha says she may stay on at Slim's ranch caring for the old woman, but mentally, I don't think any of them are free at all, because they are utterly enthralled to one man, Wayne Bent, the person they call the Messiah." Pretty strong.
Yeah, like I said before, I think that you know, I sat in the church up at Strong City, and there was, I don't know, 50 odd people that had come, not just from the land up there, but from elsewhere, all to meet me, and the photographer Jeff had kind of got them all together, and this was so that I could ask them questions and they could ask me questions. And you know, there you have a group of people, 50 odd people. I think it was more like 70 when I went before, so there have been a number that have left the church, so people that, you know, are leaving. But it's kind of interesting sitting before 50, 55 people who all have this collective belief that this guy up there is the Son of God. I mean, this is like, you know, I mean, they feel that they are, this is the ultimate for them. They've all been, it's kind of, you know, and I think that over a number of years, and we could go into brainwashing and techniques and stuff that I've done a lot of research into, but, you know, and how it's done. But I mean, you know, ultimately, they all know, and they laugh when you say that they're trapped, they're brainwashed, they can't go anywhere, because they know that they can, and absolutely they can. You know, like I said, they're working all over the place. They don't actually have to stay on the property, but it's very difficult to leave something mentally when you've been conditioned to accepting that this is the, you know, this is not just sort of, you know, it's not like, I don't know, this is not like royalty or somebody that this is the Son of God that they believe is the Son of God. So it's sort of, it's the ultimate, you know, there's no way you can leave that. If you believe that this is the person that, you know, believe he is who he says he is, then how can you leave that mentally? This is like the ultimate for them. They believe this is their spiritual destiny. And looking into their eyes, one thing I said to them, they picked me up actually on at the end of it all. They said, I said, have you got any questions for me? And they all stood up, and one of them said, yeah, I have actually. In your previous article, you said we all had we all looked like we were brainwashed, and we all had glassy eyes. And I said, and they were all standing up, 55 of them, looking at me, waiting to hear what I was going to say. And I said, well, to be honest, I'm not going to sit here and lie. You do have glassy look in your eyes, a shiny look in your eyes. And one of them said, well, shiny, why didn't you use the word shiny in the article? Shiny is much better than glassy eyed. And I said, well, okay, well, you know, the point is that you do have these kind of very big staring eyes, which are kind of got a glassy look in them, which is a, you know, I don't know, I mean, read into that what you will, but they didn't like that very much.
But it's what you, as the reporter, observed and felt and passed along.
Absolutely,
to the reader.
Absolutely, and I'm not, you know, it's, you only have to get, anybody who goes up there will see the same thing. It's sorry, Mark.
No, that's fine. I was going to ask: do you, as a reporter, still maintain what you would consider an open two-way relationship with the members from Wayne Bent on down of Strong City?
Not with Wayne Bent. I mean, he wrote to me to organize the interview. You have to, I think we did it by letter. There's a various procedures that you have to kind of go through. So we had correspondence then, but certainly not since. Jeff has always been my point of contact. In fact, the others, I think one of the other women up there emailed me about getting some audio. When I interviewed Wayne, they wanted the audio recording of the interview I did with Wayne, which I actually have to confess I haven't sent yet, but that's more because I'm useless than anything else. But
I'm trying to get at is, do you consider yourself to be on speaking terms? Because
yeah, Jeff and I speak by email semi-regularly. We talk by email. I like to keep in touch with them so I can find out what's going on. And, you know, I'd love to do more stories on them in the future.
First of all, regarding the Wayne Bent story, is there anything I haven't asked you that you would like to add?
No, I think we've covered it all.
And finally, regarding the Branch Davidian story, which you alluded to and baited us with some interesting details, where might we expect to see that? It sounds like it hasn't been published yet.
No, it hasn't. The first piece I did on them was for The Guardian, which is online, so you can see that piece in The Guardian. And the second piece is going to be in Madison magazine, which is a magazine in Australia, which is coming out in a month or 2 months, I think.
Is that, will they have an online presence as well then?
You know, Madison doesn't actually, but The Guardian does. So The Guardian one you can see online.
Okay, and alexhennaford.com, I notice on the left-hand side with your links, there are just a handful there, including articles, and people can click there and find the Guardian article, I imagine. And might you be able to, in the future, put the Madison article up there too?
Yeah, absolutely, I will do. When it's published, I'll put that up as well, yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Alex Henniford, journalist. Oh, one last question. Some might be wondering. What brought the Brit to Austin, Texas?
a wife called Courtney. she's from Dallas, actually, so my wife's from Texas.
Ah, fantastic. Alex Henniford, thank you so much for your time today. Splendid article. Enjoyed your insights. Learned something new. And good luck with you in your future and your career.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks very much.
Once again, special thanks to Alex Henniford. Today is August 8th, 2009, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I want to also mention that you can follow Beyond90Seconds.com on Facebook now. Just go to Beyond90Seconds.com and click on the link for Facebook. So long, everyone.